Well, hey there, driven woman entrepreneur. I have a question for you. We all know that we really shouldn't expect to have a sustainably successful business if we're not taking care of ourselves. So if you wanted to improve your mental and physical health, would you start by eating a healthier diet, getting more exercise, drinking more water, practicing meditation, or maybe getting more sleep? Well, if you said you'd start with sleep, the experts agree. Sleep turns out to be the cornerstone habit for well-being, productivity, and success, and most of us just aren't getting nearly enough. Here are some facts. According to Forbes magazine, more than one-third of all adults are chronically sleep-deprived, and the CDC reports that adults who get less than 7 hours per night are far more likely to have chronic mental and physical health conditions. Hey, with facts like these, plus the number of my own clients and colleagues who are talking about burnout, exhaustion, and overwhelm, I thought it was time to start a series on well-being and entrepreneurship, beginning with the focus on sleep. I turned to my friend Morgan Adams, who is a holistic sleep coach who went from an 8-year dependency on Ambien to being double certified in sleep science strategies. Morgan specializes in helping midlife women get more and better sleep, and I can't wait to share our conversation with you. Morgan, one of the things that you and I agree on, of the many things we agree on, is how important sleep is. I mean, that's what you do for a living. And I talk about it a lot on this podcast and with my clients. But let's get specific. Why is sleep so important?
Yes. Well, people like to talk about the three pillars of health: sleep, movement, and nutrition. And I feel like for a very long time, sleep has been sort of the redheaded stepchild of that trio. And my job is really to be a better PR agent for sleep. I really feel strongly, and yes, I am biased, but I feel like sleep is the foundation upon which the other pillars of health are built. So for example, if you are not getting good sleep, you're probably not going to be very motivated to exercise. You might get injured. If you haven't been getting good sleep, your food choices are probably not going to be very good. So it really is, you know, to me, at the top of the pyramid. But to answer your question more specifically, there's a whole slew of things that sleep helps with. So there's chronic disease prevention. It's helping with our cardiovascular system. It's helping prevent infection, injury. It's helping us with memory consolidation and emotional regulation. It's helping with our hunger hormone balance. And then something that I don't think people talk enough about is how it helps us in a social way. And what I mean by that is when you are well slept, you are more apt to be empathetic. You're more apt to be willing to solve conflict. And those things are extremely important, you know, that we don't touch on upon enough. I think that the physical aspects of sleep are talked about a lot and they are very important. But if we're in a work relationship or in our family or our friends, like we can all identify, like if we've had a bad night of sleep, we're kind of not as nice the next day to the people in our mm-hmm. our environment. So if people were getting better sleep overall, I just feel like the world would be a more harmonious place for sure.
And who doesn't want that? You know, this is fascinating because everybody is familiar with the expression getting up on the wrong side of the bed. Everybody knows. I mean, no one would debate the fact that if you haven't had a good night's sleep or enough sleep or enough restorative sleep or enough high quality sleep, you're going to be crabby, cranky, irritable, short-tempered, silent, whatever your particular way of presenting with that is. But I don't think I've ever actually thought about the flip side, which is, and if you do get enough sleep, you're going to be more empathic. You're going to have better social relatedness. You're going to be more present. You're going to be more available. It makes perfect sense. I just don't think I ever thought about it that way.
Yeah. Well, I think it's a good way to look at it, Diane, because we have a lot of scare tactics out there with sleep. Mm. You know, you see a lot of scary headlines, you know, if you're sleep deprived, this is going to happen, that's going to happen. And I feel like that's not a very motivating way to approach people with a aspect of change. So I think if you can flip it, like you just said so beautifully, if we can focus on the benefits and like how awesome we can feel, I think it's going to be more of a motivator for people if they are maybe not prioritizing sleep, for example.
I wish that I could agree with you 100%, but since we both studied human nature as much as we have, unfortunately, most people do seem to be more motivated by the stick than the carrot. I would like to think that's changing. I would like to think that just knowing you could be a better person would be enough to get people to sleep more. But hey, we do what we can to influence them. One thing I have noticed, though, is that women tend to have more sleep issues than men. I'm sure there's all kinds of reasons for that, not the least of which is that we have more complex lives. We tend to take on more roles and responsibilities. And then we have the whole hormonal situation. But what else is there in addition to that?
Yeah, you're spot on. Women are more apt to have sleep issues. We're about 50% more likely to have insomnia and sleep problems. And so you did hit on one of the major points, hormones. From teenagehood, you know, through menopause, our hormones are in flux, and that influences sleep. We're also, as women, more prone to anxiety and depression, and those both leave us more prone to or vulnerable to sleeping issues. And then really the last main issue is that it's a sociocultural issue. And so what that means is women are carrying so many roles in our society that it does create stress. We're constantly juggling. And so I'll just, you know, I've worked with a lot of midlife women. And so when women are in midlife, quite often they are still raising children at home and they've got kids at home they're responsible for. And then on the other end, they have parents who are aging and they're responsible for those parents. So they're sort of like a sandwich generation. And then a woman in midlife potentially is at the height of her career game and she's got a lot of demands on her from the work angle. So all of those conflicting roles and pressures can actually influence their stress level and anxiety, which influences their sleep, unfortunately.
No, it's absolutely true. It's supposed to be the time of your life where you've got everything dialed in, but the more roles you have, the more stressors you have. It makes complete sense. And I need to get the updated statistics on this, but several years ago, I've been quoting that over 40% of women at midlife are either on antidepressants or anti-anxiety meds or both. I think a whole lot of them are also on sleep meds. So I know that you have a history with Ambien, and I have a little Ambien story I can share as well. But what are your current thoughts about sleep medication? Because there's going to be plenty of people that are going to say, I'm not going to work with a sleep coach. I'm just going to get a prescription. Yeah. What do you have to say to them?
So yes, you're right. I was on Ambien for 8 years. I was psychologically dependent on it. And really, you know, I do admittedly come at the sleeping pills conversation with somewhat of a bias because my experience with the sleeping pills wasn't good. They did help me to get to sleep a little faster as advertised. But the next day, I had so much grogginess and I was just so foggy headed that it actually impacted my performance at work because I wasn't really fully awake until about noon, close to noon. And I know so what I found out, you know, most recently just by studying sleep is that in 2013, the FDA forced the makers of Ambien to change their dosing requirements for women. And lower them because essentially what was happening is up to this point, women were being overdosed on Ambien. Hence, and I was, you know, just a walking example of that because they were still having the medication in their system in the morning, hence the grogginess. And it's not just the grogginess, but like I sometimes think, well, gosh, I could have caused an accident on my way to work because I was so like just out of it still. It hadn't washed out of my system. So there are some issues with the side effects for a lot of people. About 80% of people have the same side effects, grogginess, trouble waking up, trouble focusing. But it's not a complete, like, terrible situation with the sleeping pills because they do have their place in some instances, in my opinion. And that is when you do have some kind of a tragedy in your life. You know, you've had a death or a divorce, a job loss, and you really need something in the short term to help you get to sleep. The problem is when primary care doctors prescribe the pills and they don't really give the patient an exit strategy. They just keep refilling them and refilling them. When you look at the package insert for the sleeping pills, you'll clearly see it says they're meant to be short-term use only, up to like maybe 3 to 4 weeks. But that's unfortunately not how they're being used these days. And you know, I don't completely fault the doctors, because they mostly in the United States have not had adequate training in sleep science. They get on generally about 2 hours of sleep science education in medical school, which is a little bit strange to think, because we're spending a third of our lives sleeping, right? They're getting more training on something like diabetes, for example, which doesn't affect everyone, right? Sleep affects everybody. And so wouldn't it make sense that they would have more of a knowledge base? We have work to do, Diane. We do.
No. Oh, my goodness. There's so much I could say about this, but I have so many other questions to ask you. I mean, it does not surprise me that women were being overdosed and that it took them a while to figure this out. I was not on Ambien nearly as long as you were, but I was going through a very stressful period in my life. My doctor gave me the prescription. It did help me sleep. I was absolutely groggy the next day. I felt like I had a terrible hangover without the headache. But what finally pointed me towards the fact that this was doing things that were not intended is my husband's from Germany. His family sends him these wonderful Swiss chocolates a couple of times a year. They send a whole bunch of them, and he eats them very slowly over time. I'm not so much into chocolate, so generally they're his. But during the time that I was on Ambien, the supply of these chocolates were disappearing. And he said, if you want to eat the chocolates, Di, just ask me. I said, I'm not eating your chocolates. And he gave me that look. And I said, I don't appreciate what you're implying. Why are you doing this? And he said, Diane, who else lives here? Who else would be eating them? You think someone's breaking into our house at night and just going for the chocolates and leaving everything else? I was so butthurt, Morgan. And I started thinking, where the hell are these chocolates going? Well, guess what? I started finding the wrappers at the very bottom of our trash receptacle. So I thought, whoever's eating these is trying to hide the evidence. We happened to have a part-time cleaning lady at that time, so I thought maybe it was her. Anyway, long story short, it was me. I was getting up in the middle of the night, eating an entire bar of chocolate that I don't really even like, and hiding the evidence, and then going back to sleep and having no memory of any of it. And I thought, oh my gosh. Then I started doing a little research, and I'm sure you know there's plenty of stories out there, people sleepwalking, sleep talking, sleep shopping, getting in their car and driving places under the influence of Ambien and having no recollection the next day. That is dangerous and scary.
Very, very much. And I had eating episodes similarly to what you're describing as well. I had a little more recollection about it, but certainly that was happening in my house. Interestingly, though, in 2019, because of these issues, they gave that class of sleep medications a black box warning, which is a serious kind of, I don't want to say slap on the wrist, but it's a warning to consumers that things could happen that you don't want to happen. And yeah, I mean, we didn't get damaged by our chocolates, and you know, maybe our sleep got disrupted from eating that late, perhaps, but what if we'd gotten in a car? I mean, we might not be here today. I mean, it's an extremely scary scenario to ponder on. So I'm glad you didn't do anything.
Well, yes, me too. I mean, I gained a little weight, but you know, hey, it could have been way worse. But speaking of waking up in the middle of the night, even if you're not on Ambien and you're not waking up in the middle of the night to eat chocolate, most women I know, especially those midlife and beyond, find that they can fall asleep okay. So I know there's primary insomnia, just difficulty falling asleep, and then secondary insomnia, difficulty staying asleep. And a lot of the people I know, they fall asleep fine, maybe because they're exhausted from their life. And then somewhere between 1 a.m. and 3:30 a.m., very predictably, they're waking up and then they either toss and turn or just can't get back to sleep. What is the cause of this? It's so annoying.
It is probably my number one most talked about, worried about, issue with my clients is those middle of the night awakenings. But I do want to just say, though, that we need to normalize middle of the night awakenings. Only, and here's why. It's because when you look at our sleep cycles, we have, you know, five or six during the night. It is actually very normal for us to have a brief awakening after each sleep cycle. And it's really evolutionarily designed to help us scan for safety. So oftentimes we wake up so briefly that, and our scan around the room is so brief that we don't even remember we're awake. So for a healthy adult, up to 12 times having a brief awakening at night is normal. So I just want to kind of normalize the fact that you're not broken if you have an awakening. And as we get older, those awakenings happen more frequently. It's just part of our sleep architecture changing as we age. So let's normalize that. However, yes, they are annoying as hell. I will attest. A few reasons why that happens. Often we are dealing with blood sugar issues. So for example, our blood sugar could tank at that time of night. And the consequence is rising cortisol and adrenaline level, which wakes us up. So one solve to that is to have a very small snack about an hour before bed that consists of a protein, a carbohydrate, and some fat. So like half a banana with some almond butter. That could potentially stave off an awakening. You'd have to kind of test this for yourself. Second reason that's common for these wake-ups is people are too hot. Now, it doesn't necessarily mean you're having a hot flash or a night sweat, but you're just overheated. So then in that case, we'd be working on some strategies to keep you cooler at night. Pretty, you know, fairly simple. And then thirdly, one of the most common wake-ups that I'm seeing with my population of mainly midlife people is sleep apnea incidents. So sleep apnea is something that is woefully underdiagnosed, especially in women. So quite often we think of somebody who has sleep apnea as like the Homer Simpson on the couch, middle-aged guy with a big belly snoring on the couch, making a racket, right? But we have definitely a lot of women who are in midlife who don't fit that kind of physical criteria having sleep apnea episodes. And when we are in midlife as women, our sleep apnea incidence rates match those of our peers, our male peers. Okay. So we need to be very cognizant of this. And, you know, the fix for this is getting a sleep study or getting your sleep breathing measured, talking to your doctor. And I will tell you that sometimes in my experience, women have to push for this because sometimes doctors will look at us and you know, if you're not overweight, if you're in shape, and they'll be like, oh, you don't have sleep apnea. You're athletic. You're not overweight. You have to keep pushing sometimes because you may not meet the quote criteria for getting a screening. So long-winded answer, but there are several reasons why. Those are just a few of the most common ones I see. I think that though the key takeaway when you are having an awakening at night is to try not to panic. Often what we do is we start to worry about the fact that we've awoken, and that worry and that anxiety actually perpetuates us being awake. So it's interesting with our brain when we wake up in the middle of the night is mainly working from our amygdala. We're not really in a very rational spot with our brain in the middle of the night. And so I can attest personally, I've had some of my most drastic thoughts at night, you know, just catastrophic thoughts, quite honestly. And I wake up in the morning and I'm like, I actually thought that when I woke up at night. That's crazy talk. That's crazy talk, you know? So really understanding that I think can be helpful to people to just remind themselves they're not quite thinking rationally and whatever they're thinking about, you know, let's postpone thinking about that until the morning when we're operating from more of a rational vantage point.
That's absolutely fascinating. I think I'll have to go back and think about that. Like my most irrational thoughts, when do they tend to occur? And you're right. And also because I've had sleep difficulty at different stages of my life in different circumstances. And I definitely recall that waking up in the middle of the night and not being able to get back to sleep before I sort of realized, okay, this is not catastrophic. This is not a life-threatening condition. I would start to panic and then start thinking, oh my God, it's 3 o'clock in the morning. I have to get up at 6 a.m. I've got a big day ahead of me. That means I'm only going to get, and I start calculating how much sleep I got versus how much I was supposed to get. And I'm literally working myself into a state of total aggravation. So of course, there's no chance of going back to sleep after
that. And yeah,
it did not.
And another thing you mentioned, this is something that a lot of people do. I did it myself when I had insomnia, is having a clock next to your bed, because what you'll end up doing, I did this a lot, is I look at the clock and I go, oh shit, I've only got this many hours until I have to wake up. And then you're like,
yes,
you're kind of, it just again, kicks that anxiety and stress into gear, which in turn makes it more difficult to fall back to sleep. So I tell my clients, get the clock out of your bedroom. Because when you wake up in the middle of the night, yes, it doesn't matter what time it is, it's still the middle of the night. That's all you need to know.
Yeah. Yeah. You do not need to know that it's 3:21.
No.
You really don't. That information at that time is irrelevant, unnecessary, and probably harmful. But to this point, how we love to monitor, we love to track, we love to, several people I know have wearable sleep trackers. Sometimes it's their Apple Watch or some other device. Some people have something that they put on their sheets that tracks their movement during sleep. I mean, how much of this is really necessary and helpful? Like if you're just a data, you know, oriented person, you love to know all of these things about yourself. Okay, fine, knock yourself out. But is it actually helpful, strategic, and necessary from your perspective?
So it's sort of a mixed answer. So I would say that for people who want to optimize their sleep and are able to look at the data they get from their tracker and then make behavioral changes based on that data, I think sleep trackers can be a great way to improve your sleep. However, there are some people out there, and most of my clients actually have insomnia. So people who have insomnia or anxiety about their sleep, I would definitely not recommend them using a sleep tracker, because what ends up happening a lot of the time is they see the amount of deep sleep or the amount of REM sleep, and they start to panic, like, oh my God, I didn't get X, Y, and Z. And it actually exacerbates their sleep issues because they're more about it. So what I tell my clients is, like, you know, you don't have to avoid a sleep tracker forever, but while you're in the process of overcoming this insomnia, let's just put a sleep tracker on hold, because you probably don't need it at this point. So there's not like a one size fits all answer for this. It really kind of depends on you and really how you feel you're going to react to the data. A lot of people will use a sleep tracker. I'm wearing one myself. I mean, I wear it, you know, every day, and I do check in on it every morning, kind of a part of my ritual. But if you don't want to become too focused in on the data, what you can do is wear the ring and then once a week, look back on the data to kind of get a more generalized view. So essentially, you're not looking at each day's headlines. You're kind of looking at the generality of your sleep in totality, because that's what you really want to focus on, is like, over time, is my sleep improving, you know, month to month, year to year? You don't want to get tangled up in the minutia, which a lot of people can do if they're looking at it every day.
Absolutely. And that's true of whatever you're trying to change in your life, whatever metrics you're trying to move, losing weight, being more physically fit, you know, cutting back on alcohol, whatever it is. Paying too close of attention to the data is usually not helpful and also not necessary. And to your point, why are you tracking? Are you tracking because it's a cool thing to have? Are you tracking because you just feel like you need to know day to day to day? It's not going to change that fast. What are you going to do with that information?
Right.
That I think makes a lot of sense. If you're not going to do anything different with that information, it is probably a source of unnecessary suffering and stress to know.
Yeah, I would agree with that for sure.
Hey friend, it's Diane. I hope you don't mind me interrupting this terrific interview to bring you a brief special announcement. For the last several years since I've developed the Boss Up Breakthrough Framework, the only opportunity people have had to work with me is to go through the full 12-week program. We meet every week, and it's several thousand dollars. But I realize that there are many people who love to work with me who don't need, don't want, or maybe can't afford 12 full weeks of coaching. So I've decided to do some experimentation. I'm in a big season of experimentation in my business, and I want to open things up to different types and different lengths of engagements at different price points. So there is a link to book a free consult with me in the show notes. Let's get together and talk for a few minutes about what your needs are, what your goals are, what your obstacles are, and I'll give you my honest opinion about whether I can help and what that might look like. There's absolutely no obligation, and at the very least, you'll come away with more focus, clarity, and direction than you have right now. So let's get right back to the interview, shall we? You know, one of the things that I teach my clients, most of whom are entrepreneurs with ADHD traits, are the benefits of morning and evening routines. I like to say that for people with ADHD traits, they only have three types of problems: starting, stopping, and switching gears. So to that point, you know, the starting is how you set up your morning tends to set you up in one direction or another. Stopping is sort of, you know, letting go of the waking day, letting go of work, especially for people who work from home, which can be really difficult, and then transitioning from like work mode to family mode. I'd love to know what your thoughts are about morning and evening routines and the impact that they have on sleep. Are you pro, con, or it depends?
Pro on all of it. But what I will say is that the mistake a lot of people make when they are on a journey to fix their sleep is they focus a lot of too much effort really on the evening routine. They are running themselves ragged all day, and then they're trying to cram all this stuff into like a wind down routine that wind down routine can't really sufficiently do the job because they're so wound up during the day. They haven't had a chance to de-escalate during certain parts of the day. But, you know, my real take on the morning and evening routines is that the morning routines aren't getting enough attention. And the reason I really focus in on a morning routine as a starting point for getting better sleep is better sleep starts the second your feet hit the ground in the morning. And what I mean by that is we want to build in some intentionality and predictability about our mornings. And that can look different for everybody. But I will say that, you know, I worked with a client last year who literally would spring out of bed. Well, she didn't really spring out, but she was kind of dragging herself out of bed. But she basically went from her bed to brush her teeth and get dressed. She had literally no routine at all. So she went from just the bed to driving to work. And she was very stressed during the day because she didn't have any time to ground or to build an intentionality practice to her day. So once she started doing that, things started to turn around for her. Now, with the evening routine, that is important as well. And when people ask me, what should I do during my evening routine? Well, there's no like real answer to that because it really depends on what relaxes you personally. What is the thing that makes you feel relaxed? So it's a very individual choice. But I definitely recommend that, you know, you draw a very firm boundary on your time and not have like this frenzy of work and then shut off your computer and think you can fall asleep. Like Matthew Walker, a very well-known sleep scientist, talks about sleep as like a plane. You know, it you have to descend. You don't just like crash down. So giving us that ramp, that runway of decompressing for at least a half an hour, ideally an hour would be lovely. I do have a free mini course that I offer people all about morning and evening routines for better sleep, that with some more specific guidance on that if they're just kind of getting started and need like some starting point. But again, I think they're both extremely important to build into our days and nights.
That's awesome. And I will make sure that we link to that free mini course in the show notes. You know, I have a lot of people tell me that their lifestyle is too chaotic to have any kind of an morning or evening routine. They don't have a schedule. They don't have any set habits. They are literally just, life is just coming at them one day at a time from the moment they get up to the moment they go to bed. I'm wondering what your thoughts are about the importance of mindset when it comes to making these changes, because you and I are both trained as clinical social workers, and we understand that behavior moves the needle, but mindset moves the behavior. So what are some of the things that people typically think about sleep that prevent them from even being willing to make the kind of changes that we've been talking about?
I think sometimes, at least with the people that I work with, they tend to feel like they're doomed, like they're like, quote, bad sleepers. I have a lot of clients verbalize to me, I'm a terrible sleeper, my sleep sucks. And what I really try to work with them on is really on a very basic level is their languaging around how they describe their sleep. So instead of saying, you know, I caught a client in this process just a week ago, and I stopped her and I said, I want you to kind of reflect back on what you said about your sleep. You just threw a bunch of expletives at it. And I'm not suggesting that we talk about our sleep in a way that is like toxic positivity or Pollyanna, but if you're routinely saying to yourself, I'm the worst sleeper, my sleep sucks, perhaps change the language to be at least just neutral, you know, saying I'm having some struggles sleeping, but I'm committed to working on figuring out the issue and getting better sleep. That's a lot more, it's not reeking of positivity, but it's neutral to positive, right? So I think that often that is really the first place to start, is looking at how we're talking about our sleep to ourselves and other people.
I agree with you 1,000%. My first career was in pharmaceutical sales many, many years ago. And something that I really noticed even as far back as then, and it's been confirmed many times over the years, that what works for someone often has a lot to do with their belief. When people say, well, this isn't going to work, it won't. Doesn't matter how effective it's proven to be for other people, whether that's a behavioral approach, a pharmaceutical approach, a surgical approach. And I know this is a little bit related to the placebo effect, but I truly believe that if we are certain that we cannot be successful at changing something, whether that's insomnia or any other behavior, we won't be. So I think that the obstacles that we oftentimes have to overcome are willingness to believe that we can change the situation. And certainly, as you describe, someone who says, I'm a terrible sleeper, that goes all the way to identity. Mm-hmm. That's not even saying I'm having trouble sleeping. I don't seem to be able to sleep. I've had decades of sleep problems. I'm a bad sleeper. That's an identity issue. Mm-hmm. I don't think our brains will even let us negotiate with identity. Yeah. That's really hard.
And another thing is I don't even use the word insomniac anymore. Well, I just used it. But I don't refer to my clients as that. I don't refer to myself as a former that. Because that word, you are not an insomniac. You're having an experience with insomnia or trouble sleeping. So I feel like even just saying that can be part of your identity. And sometimes people kind of relish that. Sometimes they relish the attention they get for being, quote, an insomniac, because they get a lot of coddling, you know, like, how did you sleep? You know, let me just not give you that assignment at work because you probably didn't sleep. So sometimes there's like a secondary gain. I don't run into this a lot, quite honestly, with my clients, but there are people out there like that, you know, it has become their identity, you know, as being a bad sleeper. And when you've made that your identity, you're not as likely to be open to change.
Yeah, I can't imagine someone who overly identifies with being an insomniac or a bad sleeper. That's become an identity and they are getting secondary gain from embracing that. I can't imagine them being someone who would decide to work with you, because you won't indulge that for 1 minute.
Yeah.
Right? They wouldn't get the desired results.
Right. These are the people from you. You're right. These are the people who are on insomnia Facebook groups commiserating with their fellow insomnia folks, passing along bad tips. What's the latest supplement? It's just they're now in a community that's not necessarily uplifting, but more like, I've got worse sleep than you. Let me show you right now. I'm the worst sleeper in this group, guys. I see it happening.
Everybody's got to be good at something.
Yeah, I see it happening. It's like an awful experience sometimes to hop on these groups, but I do it just because I kind of want to keep my finger on the pulse of what's going on and really understand a certain type of person who has insomnia. Yeah, it's nerve-wracking to see it, but
that's the dark side of social media, yes, that such groups exist. Yes. But in truth, we can only help the people that are ready to be helped. And because I work predominantly with business owners with ADHD traits, many people with ADHD have a lot of trouble sleeping for all kinds of reasons that we don't need to go into. But one of them is many people have a hard time sort of getting fully awake in the morning. And then they stay up too late to catch up because they haven't had enough productive hours, and it becomes kind of a relentless cycle. But in helping people who aren't getting enough sleep or helping people try to get better quality of sleep, a lot of people want to know, okay, what's the minimum amount of sleep I can get and how many hours of sleep do I actually need? I know it's not that simple, but if we're talking about quality versus quantity, what should people be shooting for if they don't have sleep problems, but just regular people who want to know that they're getting enough?
So the National Sleep Foundation does recommend 7 to 9 hours of sleep for adults 18 to 64. However, when you look at their fine print of those recommendations, you'll see that they say anywhere from 6 to 10 hours may be appropriate. So that's quite a bit of latitude. However, what we do know is that there's only about 3% of our population who is able to function properly on less than 6 hours of sleep. So all those people, you've probably stumbled across these people many times. They're like, yeah, I'm good with five. Like, I'm totally good. I'm great.
Or four. I've heard four too.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. And so unless they're part of that 3%, they're honestly kind of fooling themselves. But the quality issue is so important because I would rather see someone get 6 hours of quality sleep than 8 hours of broken, disrupted sleep. They actually did a study recently of thousands and thousands of people. It was one of those retrospective cohort analyses where they showed that if you're looking at life expectancy, there was a higher life expectancy when people had 6 hours of consistent sleep versus 8 hours of inconsistent and interrupted sleep. So that's actually pretty good news for people who at some point, like there are people out there who are, you know, they're in a place where it's hard to actually carve out the hours to sleep and they're feeling guilty that they're not getting eight. But if you can devote that six and you're making sure that it's consistent and, you know, as uninterrupted as possible, you're in a pretty decent spot overall. So we really want to build that consistency into the equation versus just focusing on the numbers, because the number doesn't tell the entire story.
I hope you're not going to tell me that this is wrong, but I usually advise people to try to keep a consistent sleep routine 7 days a week, rather so that they're going to sleep around the same time, getting up around the same time every day of the week, instead of, you know, getting more sleep on the weekend to catch up or less sleep on the weekend because they're out doing things and staying up late. What are your thoughts about the importance of consistency in terms of what many people call sleep hygiene and sleep scheduling?
Yeah, I'm a huge proponent of having that consistent wake time. We have shown, the data shows that we are really in a better spot when we have that consistency. In fact, they did a study where they showed that women who had over 90 minutes in variability in their sleep and wake times had more body fat than women who had 60 minutes or less of variability in their sleep wake times. So it affects us it affects our circadian rhythm, our metabolism. But the most important thing to that discussion is the wake time. So I'm very, very much a proponent of having a very consistent wake time every day of the week, because your brain doesn't know the difference between a weekend and a weekday.
Exactly.
So when you have the consistent wake time, what it does is it acts like an anchor. So when we've woken up, we have about 16 to 17 hours of sleep pressure, a sleep pressure chemical called adenosine building up in our brain. And at that 16 to 17 hour point is when we're sort of at our kind of max, we have to release that sleep pressure, and that's when we start to get sleepy. So if you're getting up at the same time every morning, you're fairly likely to become sleepy around the same time every night. So, you know, ideally you would want to go to bed within, like, I would say a 1 hour window. The problem with very strict bedtimes, especially for people with insomnia, is that, well, what if you're not sleepy at 10 o'clock, your normal bedtime? Well, okay, if you're not sleepy, right, just kind of wait for that wave of sleepiness to hit you and then go to bed, versus lying there for 2 hours trying to become sleepy. You just can't will yourself to sleep.
No, that makes sense. And I think, you know, if people are listening and thinking, okay, I know I'm not getting enough sleep, I know that my sleep habits are all over the place, I know I haven't made this a priority, the first thing they could do, and it's not even a baby step, it's a really important step from everything that you've said, Morgan, is that I'm going to start waking up consistently at the same time each day. What else would you want them to know if they are not yet ready to work with you or someone like you, but they do want to start moving the needle towards getting better quality and more consistent sleep? What are some other strategies that they can adopt?
So the two other strategies that I feel like are the biggest needle movers for my clients are that consistent wake time that we just talked about. Also, getting morning sunlight, or morning natural daylight, as soon as you can in the morning, ideally within like an hour of waking up. Now, I know that the sunrise is coming up at different times for us, but if you can do your best to, when the sun's coming out, get out for about 10, 15 minutes without your sunglasses. That's key. I see all these people in my neighborhood when I'm walking my dog with their sunglasses on. The reason why we don't want our sunglasses on is because when the natural light hits our retina, that sends the signal to our suprachiasmatic nucleus, which is our circadian pacemaker. And from there, there's a beautiful cascade of hormones and neurotransmitters that happen. So any residual melatonin from the night before gets shut down. It boosts your serotonin for better mood. It boosts your cortisol for energy. And it also prepares the melatonin release for that following night. So essentially, you are setting yourself up for a better night of sleep by just getting out in the morning. So it also, you know, the whole thing about the walking is kind of like you can feed two birds with one scone, because you're getting full activity, you're getting your body moving. So that's going to make you feel more alert. And then really the third thing that I think is so important, and I don't think it's talked about nearly enough, is the value of exercise for our sleep. And so they've done a meta-analysis of 13 studies showing that our sleep can become deeper when we've had exercise on a regular basis. So exercise helps not only deep sleep, it helps our quality of sleep, time to fall asleep, sleep efficiency, and our quality. So it doesn't mean that you have to knock yourself out, but if you're getting like 30 minutes of moderate exercise 5 days a week, that's probably a sufficient amount to really improve your sleep. And it's something that not only improves your sleep, but it improves your metabolism and all these other wonderful functions that we are looking for.
And that would be regardless of whether you do that exercise in the morning, afternoon, or evening, you're still getting the same benefit.
It doesn't really matter when you do the workout. Now, some people who are early bird chronotypes do prefer the morning workouts. If you're a night owl chronotype, you might prefer early evenings. The only caveat I would say is you wouldn't want to do vigorous exercise like an hour before bedtime. You wouldn't want to go out and do sprints. Sure. You could do a yoga class or whatnot, but you really want to allow your body to cool off a bit, because your core body temperature needs to be lowered in order to sleep. You don't want your cortisol increased right before sleep. So you just have to kind of dial back the real intense work, you know, an hour before bed.
So even though you have all this data and can even say some really complicated medical terms, I'm impressed, it doesn't have to be so hard. Like, what you're saying is very practical, common sense, and the benefits are enormous.
Yeah.
So I really want to encourage people to take this seriously. Go take Morgan's free course, follow her on social media, learn from her, get better sleep, because your life actually depends upon it. One of the things that I think about when I sometimes think, oh, I can just stay up late, I'm going to watch this movie or a few more episodes of something I'm watching is, you know, there's a reason why sleep deprivation has been one of the most effective forms of torture throughout all of human history, because it really freaking works.
It sure does.
So that usually gets me headed for the bedroom when I remind myself of that.
Good call.
Thank you, Morgan. This was really, really enjoyable and informative. I appreciate you.
Thank you, Diane. I appreciate it.